We'll turn again then, please, to the book of Ruth. And this is our third session in this book this evening. And we're looking then at the last part of chapter 1, Ruth chapter 1, verse 19 to verse 22. Which may seem a very small passage for us to be considering in this sermon together. After all, when working through weighty New Testament epistles where every clause and every subclause is so doctrinally dense, I've sometimes gone at a faster pace than just taking four verses. So why then take such a short section this evening? Well, I said a couple of weeks ago in our first session that really the book of Ruth, as far as I can tell, is more about Naomi than it is about Ruth. It's really Naomi's story rather than Ruth's story. It's how this woman, Naomi, moves from where she is in chapter 1, verse 5, this state of utter barrenness, without a husband, without any children, how she moves from there to chapter 4, verse 17, where the women of Bethlehem are announcing a son has been born to Naomi. So it's the story then of Naomi's movement from barrenness to having a son. And Ruth is really just the means by which that takes place. She's the mechanism from God by which Naomi is able to move from barrenness to having this son at the end of the story. And one detail, one feature that bears out my claim then, that the book is really Naomi's story rather than Ruth's story, is this, that we have much more access, do we not, into Naomi's mind than we do into Ruth's mind. Yes, okay, we saw last week Ruth's great speech, perhaps the most famous part of the whole book, there in verses 16 and 17 of chapter 1. And I said, I take it that this is a genuine profession of faith in Yahweh on the lips of Ruth here. And it's wonderful, and it's an amazing high point really in the whole of the Old Testament, isn't it? But nonetheless, do we really know Ruth? Would you say, those of you who have read the book through, do you really know this woman, Ruth? I have a feeling we probably don't get to know her all that well. Naomi, on the other hand, we get to know a little. We are given some windows into this woman. And this passage that we're looking at tonight is one such window. This is one of those passages where we're given some access into the feelings and into the thinking of this woman who I am saying is the central character in the book. So that's why then I think it is worth us just lingering this evening over these four verses. And the setting then of our passage is, of course, Naomi and Ruth's arrival in Bethlehem. They have left Moab back in verse 6 of chapter 1, having heard of the end of the famine in Bethlehem, and they've been on this journey, and it's on this journey that these epic conversations have taken place. But the setting of our passage this evening is their arrival finally in Bethlehem. And perhaps then this journey, with its urgency that we talked about last week, these timing worries, are they going to arrive at Bethlehem in time? They've heard that there's a harvest, they've heard that the famine has ended, and it seems then that they leave pretty quickly. They leave straight away, which probably reflects then this urgency. They need to get to Bethlehem quick in order to be able to reap the benefits of this harvest. And perhaps then this journey, with its urgency, with its timing worries, perhaps it's been good for Naomi. Perhaps it's enabled her to take her mind off her woes and her sorrows. But it seems then that now that she arrives in Bethlehem, and she sees, perhaps, the house where once she had lived with her husband, and where she had perhaps given birth to her two sons. And as she sees perhaps the fields where she had once walked with Elimelech when they were young, and they had talked together and enjoyed each other's company, and they had planned their future together. And as she sees perhaps Mahlon and Chilion's contemporaries there in the village, young men who are alive and well and thriving while her sons are dead and buried in a foreign land. As she sees these sights, as she smells the smells of Bethlehem, as the familiarity of her hometown just seeps in, perhaps it all becomes a bit too much for her. And it's that then that prompts this highly emotional outburst which here we have. And as we consider it then, I just want us to notice three things. First of all then, Naomi's assumption. Naomi's assumption. Now in any context, I guess Naomi's words here are fairly startling. But especially coming so soon after the delightfulness of Ruth's speech, her profession of faith, as I called it a moment ago, especially coming so soon after that, Naomi's words seem very jarring, don't they? And it's tempting, I guess, to just dismiss them as somewhat unsavory, and especially on the weekend in which we've had Valentine's Day, to rush on as quickly as we can to the love story, which we all know is coming up pretty soon. But I think before we are too quick to dismiss Naomi's words here as jarring and as unsavory, I think we ought to recognize something else. We ought to recognize that there's one very commendable aspect to them, and it's this. Naomi assumes unhesitatingly Yahweh's sovereignty, the sovereignty of Jehovah God. She might not like Yahweh's sovereignty, responsible as it is for her world having caved in around her and the deaths of her husband and two sons. She might interpret Yahweh's sovereignty as being harsh and as being bitter. But nevertheless, she never for one single moment questions that it is Yahweh's sovereignty that's responsible for everything that's happened to her over the preceding years. In other words, Naomi, she doesn't go down the pagan route of saying, well, all that stuff, all those deaths, they happened in Moab. They happened on the turf of Chemosh, the god of Moab. And therefore, it's all his doing. He presides over Moab. It's not Yahweh's jurisdiction, it's Chemosh's territory. And so he's the one who brought about the deaths of these three men in my life. She doesn't go down the pagan route. Then again, she doesn't go down the Stephen Fry route that we've perhaps, some of us, witnessed over these past few days. She doesn't ridicule the whole notion of a God in a world where there's such suffering and tragedy. She doesn't say, well, in a world where this happens, where my three beloved men can just be taken like that, there can be no God. She doesn't go down that route either, does she? Then again, she doesn't go down the route that we see in so much modern evangelicalism. She doesn't try to defend the reputation of God by saying, well, this is just a complete accident and God is just as powerless to prevent this happening as anybody else is. It's not his fault. We can't associate him with any of this. He's kind and he's sympathetic and he's on the sidelines full of empathy for me, but he had nothing to do with these events. He doesn't go down that route either. You see, we can easily shake our heads and tut tut Naomi's outburst here. We can talk about her immaturity and we can say very piously, this is what comes of emigrating to Moab and staying there for a decade or so. This is what happens. You come back bitter against God. But I wonder, do we actually have half of Naomi's understanding of just how big God is? Just how expansive his control is? Just how all-encompassing his decrees are? Just how total his involvement is with absolutely everything that ever takes place, good or bad, within this universe? You see, for Naomi, Romans 11:36, from God and through God and to God are all things. For Naomi, that's not just a cliche that appears on Christian calendars. For Naomi, that is her most basic assumption from which she views everything that ever happens in this world. It's all from God, and it's all through God, and it's all about God. And so, at the outset then, does this not challenge, perhaps this evening, our often puny and effeminate and anemic notions about God, this flimsy little God who's very nice perhaps and very inoffensive and who potters around at the edge of reality doing little bits of things but doesn't really have a fat lot to do with anything very much? Naomi's God is big, isn't he? Naomi's theism is real theism. It's not atheism with a religious veneer attached to it. This is full-blooded theism. She believes in a God, all right. Naomi's God isn't just for Sundays and for saying grace to before meals. Naomi's God isn't just to be wheeled in and then wheeled out of your life again at your own convenience. Naomi's God is massive. Naomi takes God seriously. She sees the hand of God in everything and in every place. And I'm saying then at the outset this evening, I think we all have a lot to learn from Naomi, at least in that regard. She assumes the total, unqualified sovereignty of Jehovah God. So that's the first thing then, Naomi's assumption. Secondly this evening, Naomi's confusion. Naomi's confusion. So she's clear then about Yahweh's sovereignty, and we must give her credit for that. But she is confused as well, isn't she? And she's confused then regarding Yahweh's stance toward her. It comes across in a couple of ways. First of all, it comes across in the names she uses. I mean, the names she uses then for God. She uses two names, doesn't she? And she uses them both twice. So she uses the name the Almighty. I suppose, actually, strictly speaking, it's not a name, it's a title, actually. But she uses that twice, once in verse 20 and once in verse 21. And then she uses the name, and it is a name, of course, Jehovah, Yahweh, the Lord in block capitals in our English Bibles. And again, then she uses that twice, both in verse 21. And the first then, the title, the Almighty, that really refers to God's cosmic power, God's cosmic rule, his almightiness. The second name that she uses, Yahweh, that's much more intimate and personal. It refers to God's covenant commitment to his people. Now, in saying that, I'm not being at all derogatory toward the first, toward the Almighty. That is a perfectly good and great biblical title for God. And it's one that we see believers, healthy believers in the Old Testament using often in their speaking about God. So I'm not trying to say that she shouldn't be using the title the Almighty. It's a perfectly good title for God. But I suppose what's striking here is just the way she seems to dither between the two. The way she seems to dither between the Almighty and Yahweh. And it almost seems then, doesn't it, although as a believer, she instinctively does think of God as Yahweh. He's the covenant God. He's her God. But in these circumstances, she can't quite bring herself to unreservedly think of him and speak of him in that way. The God who is doing this to her, the God who has struck down her husband and her sons. There's just this psychological barrier, it seems, to fully relating to him as the covenant God now. And there's a certain ambivalence here with Naomi. So I think this confusion, it comes across in the name she uses, but then secondly, it comes across in the imagery she uses. In verse 21, she uses court imagery. That verb testified there. As I say, it's legal imagery, it's court imagery, but it's not the happy court imagery, is it, that we have in Paul's letter to the Romans. The happy imagery then of God as the one sitting on the bench and declaring human beings righteous on the basis of Jesus' obedience. It's not that kind of happy court imagery. No, here we don't have God sitting on the bench. Here we have God in the witness box. And he is amassing evidence against human beings. In this case, against Naomi. In other words, she seems to see God here as her opponent in a court of law, as her accuser, as her prosecutor. God is bringing evidence against her. He's wanting to bring her down and lock her away in prison. He's wanting to get her condemned in court. That's how she seems to see God here. It's interesting, actually, that first sentence in verse 21, which we'll come to in a few minutes. I went away full and the Lord has brought me back empty. It's rather strangely constructed in the Hebrew. It's more literally, I full went away and emptily brought back has the Lord. In other words, in that sentence, Naomi, I, and the Lord occupy the two furthest extremes. Naomi, I at the very start of the sentence, the Lord at the very end. And I think that there's symbolism there. It's poignantly expressing how Naomi sees things. She and the Lord are at loggerheads. The Lord is against her. They're at extremes. They're not close. They're far away from each other at this point. That seems to be how she views things. So what's happening here then? Here's Naomi, and she just doesn't seem to be able to bring herself to consistently use the covenant name. And she's also then picturing God in these very hostile, antagonistic terms as an accuser in court. Well, what's happening here? Well, I think this is what's happening. Naomi here is basing her ideas about God's stance toward her on what is going on in her life. She's basing her ideas about God's stance toward her on what is going on in her life. Now, quite probably Naomi had been doing that for years. But in the past, probably that hadn't been too much of a problem. Because in the past, there were lots of good things going on, lots of happy things going on in Naomi's life. She had married this man Elimelech, and then they'd had these two sons. And then even when difficulty had come into their lives and there'd been a famine in Israel, they had managed to get out of it, and they'd moved to Moab and they'd got away from the famine. And then once in Moab, things had gone well and their sons had married these two girls, Ruth and Orpah, who, as we saw last week, even in their paganism, seemed to be good girls. They seemed to have noble instincts, noble qualities about them. And so everything had been going swimmingly for Naomi for years. And so basing then her ideas about God's stance toward her on what was going on in her life, that never caused her too much problem. But now you see, lots of bad things are going on. Lots of unhappy things are going on in Naomi's life. The husband's gone, and the sons have gone. And so now, as she bases God's stance, her ideas about God's stance toward her, on what's going on in her life. Now she finds it very difficult to conceive of God as Yahweh, the covenant God. And now she finds it very difficult to conceive of God as friendly minded toward her. And that, I'm saying then, is Naomi's confusion. That's where the problem, I think, resides. And it's a confusion to which we're still prone, isn't it? We too can easily do that. We can base our ideas about God's stance toward us on what is going on in our lives. And like Naomi, for many years perhaps, that might seem to carry us along quite successfully. Because things are fine in life. And so we can say easily, God is our God. He loves us. God is kindly disposed toward us. But what about when suffering comes along? What about when tragedy hits us? What can we conclude then except God hates me? God is against me? God has it in for me? And this is why then we need to base our ideas about God's stance toward us on something that is utterly unrelated to what's happening in our lives. We have to base our ideas about God's stance toward us on the cross of Calvary. And we need to cultivate the ability to say, I know that I am the apple of God's eye. I know that I am the delight of God's heart. Not because my bank balance is healthy, not because I've got a family, not because I'm healthy and strong physically, but because God gave his son to bear my sins on the cross. That's how I know. And whatever's going on in my life, I know it because of that. Because that doesn't change. My circumstances do. That does not. When darkness veils his lovely face, I rest on his unchanging grace. We need to cultivate the ability to think like that, don't we? We need to drop our anchor in deeper waters than our circumstances. We need to drop our anchor in the love of the cross, the sacrifice of God's Son. And we need to be assured of God's love on the basis of what happened on Good Friday. So Naomi's assumption, Naomi's confusion, but then thirdly and finally, Naomi's oblivion. Naomi's oblivion. Because I guess the most striking remark then that Naomi makes here is that remark at the start of verse 21 that I commented on in passing a moment ago. I went away full, and the Lord has brought me back empty. Now again, we mustn't be too hard on Naomi here, must we? At one level, it's perfectly understandable for her to speak in that way. Remember, this emptiness that she's talking about here, it's not the emptiness of material impoverishment. I mean, Naomi had been materially impoverished years earlier. Otherwise, she'd have never needed to go to Moab in the first place. But actually here, she looks upon that material impoverishment as her years of fullness. I was full then, she says. So in other words, she's not just whinging here because she's a poor woman and she hasn't got much in the bank. No, the emptiness she's talking about is the multiple bereavements she has gone through. This is real emptiness. Let's not be too harsh on Naomi here. She has indeed lost an awful lot. But nonetheless, we need to appreciate this, I think, that our narrator here, he wants us to perceive that Naomi is not, in fact, empty. He wants us to perceive, or she wants us to perceive, if it's a female narrator or something, that Naomi here has things to which she is in fact oblivious. She sees herself as utterly bereft, utterly empty, And we can understand her feeling like that. But our narrator wants us to perceive that actually Naomi does have things, things to which she is at this point oblivious. Three things then, quickly as we close. First of all, she has a people. She has a people. That was Ruth's profession of faith, wasn't it? There in verse 16, that your people shall be my people. And she seems to be saying then that when you get Yahweh as your God, you also get Yahweh's people as your people. You get a freebie thrown in. When you get Yahweh, you get a people as well. You get a community of believers. And that's immediately borne out then in Naomi's experience. In verse 19, we read that when the two of them arrived in Bethlehem, the whole town, the ESV says, was stirred because of them. That's not a great rendering there. I think the New King James has excited. One of the commentators renders it rather well. He says that the whole town resounded with joyous excitement. This is a strong word. It's the word we have in 1 Kings 1 verse 45 in response to Solomon's coronation. There was great excitement. And this is the word that's used there. In 1 Samuel 4 verse 5, the Israelites are encamped ready to fight against the Philistines, and someone has the idea of summoning for the Ark of the Covenant to be brought into the camp. It turns out to be a disastrous move, of course, but that's what happens. The Ark is brought, and as the Ark then comes into the camp, they all shout with great excitement. The Philistines wonder what's going on over there in the Israelite camp. But again, it's this excitement. And that's what's happening here then. These women, they are welcoming Naomi. They're not frightened. They're not just curious. They're not just kind of nosy and gossiping. They are welcoming her. They're excited to see Naomi back. And so she isn't empty. Apart from anything else, she has a people who welcome her as she returns to them after all these years away. Doesn't it remind us what a rich blessing it is to have a people, to have a church family, a church family where we are accepted for all our idiosyncrasies, a church family where we are prayed for by many other people every week, church family where it doesn't matter whether we are intelligent or unintelligent, beautiful or bland, millionaires or paupers, where we are loved and valued and wanted. It's a blessing, isn't it, to be part of a local church, to be part of the Christian family. And that then is a blessing that Naomi has here. And yet she doesn't seem at this point to realize it. So that's the first thing, she has a people. But then secondly, she has a person. She has a person. And I'm talking here then, of course, about Ruth. She isn't empty. She's come back with somebody else, with somebody who is so devoted to her that she has left her homeland to come with Naomi, and who then will immediately, as we'll see next time, immediately start to provide for Naomi. Naomi is then an older widow who doesn't have any means of income than in and of herself. But immediately Ruth will see to that. She will see to providing for Naomi. And so Ruth is a great blessing, isn't she, in Naomi's life, just at that most basic, practical level. But of course, it's more than that. As we've seen, and as I mentioned in my introduction tonight, Ruth's significance to Naomi is much more ultimately than just an affectionate daughter-in-law. Ruth is going to be the one through whom Naomi will be the channel of God's king being provided. Naomi is going to have that child, not literally, not physically, but that's what people are going to say. A son has been born to Naomi, and it's going to be through Ruth. Ruth is going to enable Naomi to be a Sarah, to be an Elizabeth, to be a Mary, to be a barren woman who actually does then produce a child who will be very significant in God's purposes. So again, Ruth isn't, Naomi isn't empty. By the way, just in this connection, it's fascinating, isn't it, the language that's used of Ruth there in verse 22. We notice that we have the word returned twice. So Naomi returned, we read, and Ruth the Moabite, her daughter-in-law, with her. Well, that's okay. But then it adds, who returned from the country of Moab? Which raises the question, well, when the dickens was Ruth ever in Moab, in Bethlehem rather, prior to this? How is she returning? Surely she's never been to Israel before. Well, I don't think she ever has been to Israel before. And it's somewhat mysterious why then we have the word returned used of her. I wonder whether perhaps it flags up another significance of Ruth in this whole story. The main significance of Ruth is that she is the mechanism, the means by which Naomi will have her son. But the other significance of Ruth, I guess, is that she is a Gentile being incorporated into the people of God. She's a Moabite. Where did the Moabites come from? We can read the story of that in Genesis 19. That's an unsavory tale if ever there was one. Lot's daughters getting Lot drunk and sleeping with him. And it was from those incestuous relationships that the Moabites came. And it's kind of part of the trajectory of those early chapters of Genesis, isn't it? This kind of breaking up, this ethnic splitting off, Babel classically, where you have the nations kind of being separated and all splitting off from one another. But you have it there too, because of course Lot is related to Abraham. But then it's from that stock then that the Moabites are kind of an offshoot, a splitting away. And so you have that trajectory in the early chapters of Genesis. But then of course you move on through the Old Testament and you come to much brighter passages. Passages which seem to indicate that one day there's going to be a reuniting of all these split off ethnicities. Psalm 67 that we sang a few minutes ago, classic example. The psalmist looking forward to the nations joining together as one in praising the one true God. And fascinatingly there in Psalm 67, that vision presented in harvest imagery, that there's going to be this harvest, and it's not talking about a physical harvest, but there's going to be this greater harvest of the nations as the nations are united in the praise of Yahweh. So that's the kind of the Old Testament vision. And we come to the book of Ruth, and it's certainly not happening yet, but there's just a little hint of it. Here's one Moabite at least who's returning to the ancient stock, who's returning to the homeland, returning to Abraham's line, and doing so at harvest time. And this narrator, like many of the biblical narrators, is skillful, and I'm sure the reference to the barley harvest there isn't just a purely factual thing, but perhaps a reference to Psalm 67 and other passages like that, where this ingathering of the nations is presented as a harvest. And of course it's now, isn't it, in these days that that harvest is being brought in. And the nations are being united in the praise of Yahweh. And there are millions of people tonight around this globe who worship the same God, Jesus Christ. And Ruth then, I'm saying, is perhaps just a little pointer to that, a little hint, a little taster, the one Moabite returning and being reunited with the people of God. But Naomi then, she has a people and she has a person, but then thirdly, she has a pattern. She has a pattern. What do I mean by that? Well, I mean this. I mean, she knows somewhere in her mind, she knows about God's pattern of using emptiness to bring about fullness. She knows that this is classic Yahweh, that he brings fullness out of emptiness. I mean, we've already talked about Sarah. And you think of the emptiness of her decades of infertility. And then, out of that emptiness, the fullness of Isaac bursting onto the scene, the child of promise, and all that then followed from that. But it's not just Sarah, it's everywhere, isn't it? You think of Joseph, and you think of the emptiness of his being sold into slavery, being imprisoned for something he hadn't done, spending years in an Egyptian jail, and then how out of that emptiness God brought about the fullness of Joseph rising to the very top of Egypt and indeed rescuing a good portion of the known world at that time by his planning. Think of Job and the emptiness of his suffering and his bereavements and his deprivations. And then how at the end of the book, out of that emptiness, God brings fullness. More chronologically close to this, you think of Gideon and the emptiness of his tiny, puny little army that God kind of shaved off more and more of until he's just these 300 soldiers. How are they going to do anything? Yet out of the emptiness of it, God brings about this fullness of victory and liberation for his people. It's written all over the Old Testament, beyond Naomi, what she couldn't have known about. There'll be more of it. Think of Esther's emptiness, the emptiness of that woman whose whole people, whose whole race is condemned to die on a certain day in a few months' time. And then how out of that emptiness God brings about the fullness, not only of that decision being reversed, but the Israelites coming out on top over all their enemies at the end of the book of Esther. And this theme then of God bringing fullness out of emptiness, it continues into the New Testament, doesn't it? And of course it has its very climax. Where? At the cross of Calvary, doesn't it? Paul uses the very Greek verb that we have in the Greek version of Ruth 1:21 here. Philippians 2:7. He made himself nothing. Literally, he emptied himself. Christ emptied himself at the cross. Utterly empty, wasn't he there? Had nothing, no clothes even. Utterly naked and bereft, forsaken even of God himself. He didn't even have God at the ninth hour on the cross. And yet out of that emptiness, God brings the fullness of a multitude no man can number, who are saved from hell because of what Jesus did. And then, of course, it continues, doesn't it, the other side of the cross, as a pattern in the lives of God's new covenant people. 2 Corinthians 4 that we read earlier on there. Paul talks about how I'm constantly being given over to death in order that life may flow from me. And death is at work in us, he says, us apostles and preachers, but life is at work in you. And again, then out of emptiness, God bringing about fullness. And perhaps it's a principle that some of us can testify to in our own lives this evening, that at times God has emptied us. At times God has stripped us. But out of that emptiness, we can now see, although we couldn't at the time, he has brought forth fullness, all kinds of blessings and benefits we couldn't possibly have envisaged. And Naomi then, she doesn't know that full pattern that I've just explained to you, but she knows bits of it from Sarah and Joseph and Job and so on. But the main point then here as we close is that Naomi then, she has blessings here that she's oblivious to. And as we said, you can understand that at one level. But nonetheless, the narrator wants us to see that she's not empty. She has a people, she has a person, she has a pattern. And actually, we are never empty either, are we? The old chorus encourages us to count our blessings, and we're poor at that, aren't we? Good at counting the problems, poor at counting the blessings. But may God help us when things are tough, when we're going through hard circumstances, not to be oblivious, but to be aware, even then, of the innumerable ways in which God is still blessing us and still being so good toward us. Amen. Well, our final hymn, a brief doxology.